Chapter 1. Gabby Pito found by YouTubers. FBI raids Brian Laundrie home after failing to locate him.
What's going on, everyone? Jeremy here from The Quarrying with an update in the Gabby Petito case. Looks like, you know, based on your feedback, people are pretty interested in following this as it goes through. So make sure you hit that red subscribe button down below to be notified each and every time I upload. Now, what's interesting is a couple new little nuggets came out today, including we now know that Brian, we assume, is in the van at the time. You can see video shows Gabby Petito's van door closing 3 days after last sighting. Enhanced video footage of Gabby Petito's van, purportedly filmed after her last known sighting, has surfaced online, appearing to show the back door of the vehicle being closed as another car approaches. The chilling moment was spotted by Brent Shavnor, a U.S. Marine Corps veteran turned videographer, who noticed the movement on the video first posted on YouTube. The Bethunes captured the encounter on their dash cam, traveling cross country. They say the footage was recorded in Spread Creek, Dispersed Camping Land, Grand Teton National Park. I think Dispersed Camping Land just means like, you know, you're good. You can camp basically wherever you want. Wait, I wanted to see the... Well, show me the video. Video picked up movement around the van. Shavnor was able to further enhance the footage. But, of course, Newsweek is not going to link to it because they're probably not getting paid. Which is pretty crummy. Shout out to Brent Shavnor here. Thanks to the raw 2.5K video released by Red, Wright, and Bethune, I was able to further enhance the footage of the back door of the Gabby Petito Brian Laundrie point, where you can clearly see the back door abruptly close. Let's check this out. Oh yeah, you can see it's open there. You can see the door's open here. And then, boom. I mean, I don't know if you can say it's abruptly. It says, as requested, here's a second anomaly some thought might have been Brian digging in the creek. You can see in the enhanced video that the black figure is not a human figure, more aligned with being terrain. Oh, right over there on the left. I mean, the idea is, he writes on, answer your question regarding the significance of the door closing, building a timeline of the case is important. The door closing adds whether or not information on the timeline. Someone was alive in the van where Gabby was found on August 27th. And you can see here, front passenger seat, wind slowed down and exposure, contrast, and brightness altered. Clearly a male passenger in the passenger seat resembles the boyfriend. Yeah, I mean, you can see it does look like him there. Brightness increased higher. You can see if that's what they're talking about, you know, if it was him. There's been a lot of mention of a face appearing in the passenger window as a vehicle passes by Gabby's van for a second time. As requested, here's the spot up close in question. Pretty creepy three frames. I don't know if maybe... See, I wasn't even looking at the... Oh, right here. That is creepy. Okay. So he's looking out the window. Yeah, that's, I mean, could it be like a really bizarre phenomenon? Maybe, but it looks pretty much like a dude. As requested, here is the windshield, the Red, Wright, and Bethune. We're leaving. Not sure you can make anything definitive. There's definitely someone in the van, and I'm pretty sure it's him. I don't know why that's that surprising. You could see him here, and when the video plays between 3 and 4 seconds, his face is against the window. So as they're driving by, he's peeking out and he's looking. Oh, he's right here. Yeah, it looks like he is. It's possible You know, the picture of their van, though, there is a wall. So he'd have to be up front. Oh, there's a blanket hanging. There looks to be some type of bag in the front seat. So maybe he was laying down. Maybe he was there. What do you guys see? This is actually getting pretty interesting. You know, it appeared to be Brian's, as they were a few inches shy of the size 15. Oh, they're talking about the shoes that were also found. There were also shoes found that it also looks to be Brian's, not Gabby's. On top of all of this, there is new information on a 911 call that he claimed he saw Brian Laundrie slapping Gabby Petito. A massive search is continuing in Southern Florida for Brian Laundrie, the boyfriend of Gabby Petito, the 22-year-old woman who went missing on a cross-country trip. Here's the thing. Here's something a lot of people are talking about, too. Did the parents help get him out of there? Because it certainly looks suspect that basically people were watching this house 24/7 and somehow the boyfriend got out. You know, he's been named as a person of interest in the case. But according to this call, he claimed he saw him hit her. Now, we do know that by her own admission, she hit him in this incident. But the call is what led to this traffic stop. Apparently, he was chasing her up and down a sidewalk and raising his hands to her. We drove by, the gentleman said, and the gentleman was raising his hand to her. He told the call, and then we stopped. They ran up and down the sidewalk. He proceeded to raise his hands to her, hopped in the car, and drove off. What's interesting is then the PD stops, interviews them, and lets them go their separate ways. If you look at this, you know, this scenario, boy, I mean, I wonder if they had arrested somebody in this. You might, you know, you don't want to think about that. You see, Nancy Grace here saying, how long has Brian Laundrie really been gone? She questions how Lundy could have left the house unseen considering constant press coverage. Is it possible that he snuck out at, you know, 4 a.m. when everyone is asleep? Yeah, sure, it's possible. But it's an interesting thing, and maybe that's why the parents were questioned. And there was this red herring, perhaps, about the Carlton Reserve, which is a nature preserve where Brian Laundrie was supposedly headed. She writes, with all the press and citizens outside the home, how did Laundrie get out and nobody noticed? That place has been staked out 24/7. Did he really go to the Carlton Reserve? Why do we believe that? Other than that's what the parents said. I don't understand how the car could have left with him in it. And then the parents bring it back and nobody sees any of this happening. I'm also very concerned about the condition in which Gabby was found. You know, what would that tell us? Well, obviously, yeah, you'd want to know, you know, is there evidence of foul play? Was it, you know, a slip and fall? Was it, I mean, it's difficult to know for sure. You know, there's also this weird thing where he checked in on her phone in Puerto Rico. That's really interesting, isn't it? I wanted to pull that up quick. I forgot to put up the article. This is just 2 days ago. And you see social media users think he's fled to Puerto Rico. Gabby Petito's family says her fiance is hiding and people think they know where. Social media users think Brian is in Puerto Rico based on Google geotagging data from their hiking and app All Trails. Investigators are now working with multiple missing persons investigation. It's interesting to me. You have in a statement they think he's hiding. Obviously, he's had weeks now to get ahead. You see, can't sleep because all I can think about Gabby case when user tweeted. Now looking at their All Trails account, assuming it's really hers, why is it saying Puerto Rico? In a follow-up tweet, that user wrote, do we think that Brian Laundrie has her phone and has fled to Puerto Rico? It's easy from Florida But wouldn't the airport notify anyone? Well, what if you took a, you know, a private jet or a charter flight? I don't know how all that works. Another user posted a screenshot of direct flights from Tampa. It's not far from Northport to San Juan, Puerto Rico. Spirit Airlines, American Airlines, Frontier, JetBlue all offer flights from Tampa to San Juan. And the thing is, he could have gone before anyone was even looking for him. Now, if they find him in Puerto Rico, you know, they'll still be able to extradite him to the United States. But things are getting spicy. I suspect more information will come out tonight. I'll make sure I keep you all updated on that.
Chapter 2. Hollywood elite demolished over maskless Emmy Awards. Seth Rogen reveals his hypocrisy.
And I get to do one of my all-time favorite videos. And that's when Hollywood gets roasted. That's right, Hollywood, the elitist. It's like we've seen so many events between the Met Gala and last night's Emmys that are basically like the Hunger Games, where you have elitist, super rich celebrities living by a different set of rules. People who are happy to go on Twitter and tell you that you're subhuman if you don't get the poke. Gathering in a large room, sitting shoulder to shoulder with each other, taking pictures and having dinner and all the things that you plebs, you plebeians, your second-class citizens, the things you can't do, in fact, things that they tell you can't do, they can do because money. Well, last night, at least for a moment, people decided to point out this fact, and it was pretty good. You see here, Emmys go maskless, get blasted. Masking is solely reserved for the peasants, this via the Daily Wire. On Sunday night, the Emmys were held in an enclosed tent with a slew of celebrities parading around unmasked, triggering condemnation on social media. Some of the Emmy presenters commented on the fact that the event was not held in an open-air venue and pokes were not even required of the celebrities. Interesting, isn't it? Now, obviously, everyone knows my position is, of course, you do you, and I'm not going to make any aspersions or proclamations or demands of my viewers other than that maybe you consider clicking that red subscribe button right down below the video. YouTube is purging subscribers across, well, basically all of YouTube right now. It'd be great if you just double-check that you're still subscribed, and if you haven't yet, consider doing so. Seth Rogen claimed, they said this was outdoors. It's not. They lied to us. We're in a hermetically sealed tent right now. I wouldn't have come to this. There's way too many of us in this little room. Here's what's interesting and what kind of highlights that what's more important to Seth Rogen is virtue signaling than safety. Because here's how a normal person would react to was actually concerned, okay? They would go up, see that it's a enclosed tent, and said, I truly believe the things that I say and that people should social distance, and they haven't, and they told us it was going to be outside. It's not, so I'm going to leave. And see, if Seth Rogen actually believed the things that he said, he could have even virtue signaled and done this. He could have stood outside the event, posted a Twitter video or an Instagram video talking about how they told him that it was going to be outdoors and that he doesn't feel that it's safe to continue. But that's not what Seth Rogen did. Seth Rogen made sure he gobbled up all that limelight because, I mean, quite frankly, the man hasn't done anything of note in Hollywood in 15 years, so he's not going to miss out on that opportunity. Not like the pores that he says should. The show's DJ Reggie Watts added, despite what Seth might have said, we're going to celebrate and party. But while we're doing this, we're absolutely following all the health and safety guidelines that some really smart people asked us to do to keep safe. Really? Doesn't really look like it. Doesn't really look like you're even social distancing. Cedric the Entertainer Chainer chimed in. It feels really amazing in here. Unlike what Seth was talking about, it feels good. We're all poked. We had to get poked to come here. I got poked. I did not have a reaction like Mickey Minaj's cousin's friend. I got this one because I'm bougie. Okay. Many social media users had no use for any excuse, especially after recent star-studded Met Gala, where celebrities paraded around maskless. Fox News meteorologist Janice Dean, I think after seeing all the celebs without masks or social distancing in a packed tent at the Emmys, we should pretty much move on with our lives. She added, but they're poked is my favorite response to that packed tent celebrities with no masks. Well, you can still spread it if you're poked. That's a known fact. Tom Cotton of Arizona saying, these same liberals sanctimoniously mocked Republicans for giving their parents a choice about masks. They're all frauds. And that includes Fauci, who removes his mask whenever the cameras are off. Former military aide to President Bill Clinton, Buzz Patterson, Emmys equals no masks. Our college and high school sons, masks. Where's the outrage? Outkick founder Clay Travis said, why did none of the celebrities at the Emmys have to wear masks indoors, but all the kids age 2 and older have to wear them in preschool in Los Angeles? It's almost as if, and you know what's actually more hilarious, is the pictures that show the celebrities without masks, but the people cleaning up after them, the people who serve them food, the people who, you know, carry their dresses, they have to wear masks. I mean, these pictures say 1,000 words. You see, the rich and famous can't spread the coof. Masking is solely reserved for us peasants, poked or not. And you see the peasants, the people who work there, all wearing masks. Why Hollywood celebrities don't. One social media cognitively pointed out, why is it that the only the help have to wear masks at the Emmys? First it was the Met Gala, and now this. Seems that the coof gives you a pass if you're wearing a black tie or a designer frock. Or maybe it's just rules for one group and one for another. Well, of course. The LA County Health Department's current mandate requires attendees at indoor events with more than 1,000 attendees to wear masks at all times except for when eating. Now, I don't know if there were more than 1,000 people at the event or not, but it's pretty curious, isn't it? Seth Rogen isn't happy about what went down at the Emmys on Sunday night, and he's spending Monday trending because of it. The actor-comedian had a few choice words to say about the actual live awards ceremony and is also taking some flack for his choice of outfits. So from a social media standpoint, he's taking hits on a couple different fronts. Rogen got up on stage, this is via a giant freaking robot, by the way, during a presentation on Sunday and pointed out a few words about the venue, the protocols, and what was being done about the situation as he saw it from a safety perspective. Again, nobody's forcing you to be there, Seth Rogen. Nobody forced you to go to this bougie event. Nobody forced you to speak at it and be on camera. You chose to do that. You have more money than anyone would ever need to live, and you did this as a choice. They said this was indoors. They lied to us. This is in reference to organizers apparently offering solace around the lack of space in the venue, telling those who are coming that the Microsoft Theater at LA Live in Los Angeles is going to be an outdoor venue. There was more, too. Rogen keeps a foot on the gas by saying, why is there a roof? It's more important that we have 3 chandeliers than we make sure we don't kill Eugene Levy tonight. You could see Rogan's comments below. Decide whether or not you think he was joking about the situation or if he's actually miffed about showing up. No. It is third. It's a third option. It's that you don't care. You want your cake and you want to eat it too. You want to stand up there and moralize to the plebeians about, you know, what they should be doing while buying your product and consuming your product. And then you want to pretend like you're outraged because you knew that people would be pissed off. You knew people would be pissed off when they saw this, and that's why you said that. Twitter lashes out over celebrities at 2021 going maskless. Because of recent surges show the coof is still a thing, Emmy host Cedric the Entertainer even joked about it in his opening monologue. Cue the Twitter reactions. Me. Why are the Emmys in such a small room without masks and no ventilation during the coof? 30 seconds later, Seth Rogen. Why are we in such a small room without masks and no ventilation during a lockdown? Again, Nobody forced you to be there. Eric Bott, no masks at the Emmys because the rules are for the little people. Adam Ellison writes, no masks being worn inside at the Emmys. Call me not shocked. Love to preach, but not to practice what they preach. The Emmys weren't the only big Hollywood event that fans got upset over the COOF rules. Stop buying their products then, right? It's pretty clear. I don't think that there's any question that Hollywood considers themselves better than you. This is clearer than, I mean, these are the same people that all told you to vote for the same person, who all told, you know, that person tells you, the general public, that your toddlers need to live in fear and wear their masks forever and ever. But all of these people, and by the way, I'm getting conflicting information on whether or not they were actually required to get the poke, but that doesn't matter because what they're required to do is remind you that there are two groups of people, the haves and the have-nots. And as a have-not, this is what I've always said. The lockdowns and the COOF, this isn't a thing that exists for rich people. It just doesn't. Joe Rogan gets the COOF. What does he do? Chopper in his doctor who writes him 25 prescriptions. Then he has an assistant that goes gets those prescriptions. And a cook that cooks him dinner and puts his pills in his mashed potatoes. All right? These people don't live the same way that they don't live by the rules that they often espouse. Now, Joe Rogan isn't exactly moralizing over people, but you get the point. None of these people are going to die from the COOF. All right, unless they're already super old. What they are interested in doing, though, is telling you that they're better than you.
Chapter 3, Kathleen Kennedy is roasted by George Lucas's ex-wife, Marcia Lucas.
What's up, everyone? Jeremy here from The Courting. I hope you're having a wonderful day. Interestingly enough, there was a kind of a bombshell spicy comment from a Star Wars editor, Marcia Lucas, decimating Kathleen Kennedy and J.J. Abrams over sequel trilogy. Pardon me while I take a sip of tea. Delicious. Star Wars editor Marcia Lucas, who worked on the original Star Wars films, The Empire Strikes Back and The Return of the Jedi, called out Kathleen Kennedy and J.J. Abrams for the destruction of the Star Wars franchise. Lucas, who won an Oscar for Best Film Editing for the original Star Wars film back in 1977, made her thoughts about the Disney sequel trilogy quite clear in a recently published book titled Howard Kazanjian, A Producer's Life. I know I probably pronounced that wrong. By recently passed Star Wars author J.W. Rinzler. In the book, as reported by YouTuber Open Airlock Policy, Lucas described the sequel trilogy storylines as terrible. Lucas stated, I like Kathleen. I've always liked her. She was full of beans. She was really smart and really bright. Really wonderful woman. And I liked her husband, Frank. I like them a lot. However, she then added, now that she's running Lucasfilm and making movies, it seems to me that Kathleen Kennedy and J.J. Abrams don't have a clue about Star Wars. They don't get it. She specifically pointed to the ending of Han Solo and Luke Skywalker, and J.J. Abrams is writing these stories. When I saw the movie where they end Han Solo, I was furious. I was furious when they ended Han Solo. Absolutely, positively, there was no rhyme or reason to it. Lucas added, I thought you don't get the Jedi story. You don't get the magic of Star Wars. Are you getting rid of Han Solo? Well, look, yes, of course they were getting rid of Han Solo because toxic man, but also like Mark Hamill can't play, or, you know, they had Mark Hamill out there at like 1,000 years old, and they weren't going to have, a 90-year-old Han Solo out there. But anyway, as for Luke, she noted, well, I suppose you do. I mean, you have Yoda, who's like 300 years old or whatever. But anyway, by the end of the last one, The Last Jedi, they have Luke disintegrate. They killed Han Solo. They ended Luke Skywalker. And they don't have Princess Leia anymore. And they're spitting out movies every year. Well, you know, Princess Leia is like, you know, the actress is literally gone.
Harrison Ford is, what, 80-something, blowing out his hip every time he walks too fast. And Mark Hamill's probably the youngest of them all, maybe, and he's also way up there. So watching these geriatrics, I suppose you could have a way to include them, like as trainers or something like that in the storyline that made more sense. You know, the Force allows you to still be really powerful, even though you're really old and frail. So you could have probably kept using them, but that's not what Kathleen Kennedy wanted to do. And on top of that, I'm sure that Disney doesn't want to pay Mark Hamill and Harrison Ford numbers when they could just bring up literally anybody to plop in Star Wars because they think it's formulaic, just like Marvel movies. Then Marcia Lucas would take issue with Kennedy's attempt to appeal to women within the introduction of Rey, And they think it's important to appeal to a woman's audience. So now their main character is this female who's supposed to have Jedi powers, but we don't know how she got Jedi powers or who she even is. It sucks. The storylines are terrible, just terrible, awful. Lucas then added, you can quote me, J.J. Abrams, Kathleen Kennedy, talk to me. Now, maybe Marcia is just looking for some work. I don't know. But it seems unlikely. Not only did Jedi Scum 83 share Lucas's thoughts on the sequel trilogy, she also discussed her thoughts on the prequel trilogy, especially episode one. Lucas stated, George is in his heart and soul a good guy and talented filmmaker. I wish he would have kept directing other kinds of movies. But when I went to see episode one, I had a friend who worked at ILM who took me as a guest to a preview. I remember going out to the parking lot, sitting in my car and crying. I cried because I think it was very good. Episode one. She elaborated, and I thought he had such a rich vein to mine, a rich palette to tell stories. He had all those characters, and I thought it was weird that the story is about this little boy. I think it was very good. Oh. Little boy who looked like he was six, and then later he's supposed to get with this princess who looks like she was 20. There were things I didn't like about casting and things I didn't like about the story, and I think I didn't like a lot of it was eye candy CG. Mark Hamill had a different opinion of the prequels, noting, I was impressed that the prequels had their own identity, that they were criticized because... So I don't understand this quote. I remember going out to the parking lot, sitting in my car and crying. I cried because I think it was very good. Okay. Lucas would also address claims that she was the heart of Star Wars. I wouldn't so. I definitely made scenes work. I made the end battle work, she stated. I definitely had a lot to do with making it work. But I wasn't the writer and I wasn't the director and I didn't come up with the creative names, Darth Vader, Luke Skywalker, and all those names are classic. George came up with all of that using his amazing imagination. Well, I think that, you know, ultimately, if we look at, you know, kind of how people have responded to this, I think it resonates with a lot of existing Star Wars fans. I mean, I think it's, you know, ultimately, when you have a product like Disney has purchased, okay, they want to milk it to the max. But if you look at this quote, it obviously resonates with a lot of people. Marcia Lucas on Disney produced Star Wars films. You can see a lot of these replies. People thought it was a fake quote. I don't appreciate being suspected of faking this quote. I cite the new book, and it's from the tweet above. It's on page 333 if you want to get specific. So, like, modern fans, the modern new, you know, the NU Star Wars fan, they can't even believe it. They think it's fake. Then there are people saying, I'm sorry, but reading this shows how little she knows about Star Wars and how little she paid attention to any of the movies. Like, are you joking? She literally worked on them. She was the lead editor on the original. She's a bit more invested than you or I. I mean, I hate to say it, dude, but she's kind of the reason A New Hope isn't terrible. I mean, that's the modern day Star Wars fan. She hated the prequels too, LOL, what's the source? You know, people keep saying that people can't believe that anyone would dislike the prequels. or dislike, you could see it's actually Marcia Lewis is trending now. I didn't even notice that. Star Wars editor Marcia Lucas destroys the sequel trilogy. Kathleen Kennedy and J.J. Abrams don't have a clue about Star Wars. The main character is this female who's supposed to have Jedi powers, but we don't know how she got it. Storylines are terrible. Their main character is female who's supposed to have Jedi powers, but we know how she got them. Lamau, what? Bruh. And how did Luke get his powers? The heck is she even trying to prove at this point? Yeah. People kind of knew. There's a lot of books. And what's crazy is you see Marcia Lewis saves Star Wars in the edit. So she could say whatever she wants, but she's wrong. I mean, you could disagree with her, but I do think it's hilarious that all these modern day new fans are in utter disarray. Now, of course, there are people that, if you look at some of the quote tweets that are into it, you know, like there's so much ammo in terms of how you could criticize the sequel trilogy without going for this very out of nowhere misogyny. Wokeness destroying Star Wars. Does she think? I mean, yeah. I mean, I think so. I don't understand why people would think. And these are modern Star Wars fans. They all seem to kind of have the same kind of, the same kind of opinions or avatars and things like that. But yeah, I don't know. She did do her work on the originals. It's possible that, you know, she's just salty, but I find that unlikely. I think we don't know how she get our Jedi powers is a weak argument. I don't disagree with that. I mean, it's kind of like you're just born with them, you know? But she just basically doesn't like Rey. Is that what I'm guessing? She doesn't like the Mary Sue stuff like that. And the new fans are in full damage control. All these anime avatars. This is such a silly take. Okay. Doesn't mean they don't suck. Eat it, Kathleen Kennedy.
Chapter 4. Kotaku slanders Jeremy in totally unrelated article about Intellivision Amico.
It's fairly clear that I am a relatively understanding man. I think, you know, lost in kind of all the hilarity and over the top response to stuff. When the chips are down, I'm pretty understanding. But over the weekend, an editor at Kotaku decided to call me something not only hilariously untrue, but completely unprompted, a label that is so vile and so damaging that I can only assume they are attempting to damage my career, damage my ability to get sponsors, and they did it maliciously. There was an article over the weekend about the Intellivision Amico. It's a retro remake console that you may or may not have heard about. What do I have to do with this? Absolutely nothing. But for some reason, Mega Galaxy Brain Zach Zweizen decided to meander around and include a bizarre line calling me a white supremacist. Obviously something that is hilariously untrue. Now, the reason that I care about this stuff is because when you Google my name, when sponsors look for me, if you include my name, which is why they do this stuff, this kind of stuff comes up. It actively hurts my ability to earn money. This is a point I made quite clear to the last game journalist who decided to slander me and commit libelous statements about me, in which their boss called me on my cell phone, apologized, they removed the article, and printed a retraction, which is what you're supposed to do when one of your editors or writers says something that can get you sued. Now, Kotaku.com is on its last legs. We all know this. The endless layoffs, the mass exodus of employees probably means that I think it's Patricia Hernandez, I think, as senior editor now, leaves her with quite a bit to look over. But this particular article is one that is likely, a statement about me is likely to get them sued if they don't remove it, retract it, immediately. Now, I didn't say anything about this all weekend long. That's how reasonable and nice I am. Okay? I contacted the author, Zach Zweizen, directly and asked him to remove this. He never replied. And so now I have to make a video about it. I sent Zach a DM, quite frankly, that was pretty specific. I wrote, in your latest piece on the Amico, you literally called me a terrible thing. Are you trying to get Kotaku sued? I misspelled that. Please correct this immediately. That was several hours ago. Now, no reply. So now I get to make a video that I will ask that you share, that you put on social media, and let Kotaku know that they are headed down a dangerous financial path. And to the people that would doubt me on this, I think you only need to look up my track record. Okay, I'm not joking around when I say that I will be unleashing the half Asian super lawyer if this is not fixed. The new gaming console that became a giant car crash explained. And the sad thing about Zach is he's probably a good writer, but his own personal vendettas or ideological positioning has caused him great financial trouble. On October 22nd, 2018, Intellivision unveiled the Amico, a family-friendly retro console. The pitch, the games will be simple and to play and cost no more than $8. The console will cost about $180 and all games being exclusive. In the initial trailer, the Amico was given a release date of October 10th, 2020. A year and three delays later, a lot has changed. Today in 2021, the console is now available simply for pre-order for $250 to $300, double the cost. The games can cost as much as $20, not $8, and they won't all be exclusives. It would be easier to excuse these changes if the end product seemed exciting enough, but the console's projected specs and television's shady investment pitches and the poor behavior of CEO Tommy Tallarico makes it hard to get excited about the Amico. Now, I don't know who Tommy Tallarico is. Maybe I've interacted with him once or twice on Twitter. I don't know the man personally. I don't really care. What I care about is this journalist printing slanderous lies about me. Before diving into the nitty-gritty of the console, it's also worth knowing about Tommy Tallarico, who has become the face of Amico. Tallarico purchased purchased the rights to the original television name, brand name, and all of its classic games in 2018. Well, you might recognize his name from old episodes of Judgment Day or Electric Playground. Don't even know what those are. Tallarico is primarily known for the creator of concert series Video Game Live. He also composed music for numerous games. He's also quick to speak his mind, which often leads to issues. Tommy Tallarico posts on the Atari Age forums frequently. He replies to folks around a dozen times a day, sometimes more. Many of those posts are what you'd expect. But if you dig around more, you'll find some truly bizarre ones. Tommy has insulted critics, so. Reporters, good. And YouTubers, I don't know about that, who are critical of the Amico, even calling some of these people gaming-ists and mentally unstable. He also refers to critics as idiots, morons, and has told them to return to their safe spaces when they won't challenge him in an interview. Tallarico routinely participates in thread wars, arguing with people for hours a day. Don't care. None of that matters to me. I think it would be hard to find a CEO that isn't, problematic in some way, shape, or form. Some sort of bizarre world where I need to like a game company's CEO to play their games. I suppose it does happen. A great example of Tallarico's odd behavior as CEO came after the Ars Technica report about the publicly archived Amico Dev Portal and all the specs and info about it revealed. Tallarico, in response to that part, insulted the author of the article and threatened legal action in an odd and now deleted series of tweets that was saved by Game History Org founder Frank Cifaldi. It was also dragged up during a time during all of this. Now, here's where it gets totally bizarre. It was also dragged up during all of this that Tommy follows many right-wing white supremacists on Twitter. Now, they printed this line as a fact There's no quotations. This is just Kotaku.com saying these people that they are following are white supremacists, opening them up to significant potential damage. Who are these people? Well, me, apparently, with no evidence. Dan Crenshaw and Tommy Lahren. Okay, so Kotaku.com is now just saying, if you're a Republican in Dan Crenshaw's and Tommy Lahren's, you know, case, you are a supremacist. For me, I don't even consider myself a Republican. I don't know why on earth you brought this up. And I do find it's interesting that Dan Conlin, whoever showed this, has me blocked, but not an impersonator account. So, Dan, I'm curious. This actually disappeared in the near history because this used to come up before. You can say this all you want, but what's the famous line you people always say? This is consequence culture. You have freedom of speech, but not freedom of consequences. Well, Zach Zweizen, look, your article, this is just a perfect example of how these lunatics let their political affiliations ruin their life. This is probably a good article about the MECO. You know, the first part of it's pretty good. Looks like they spent a lot of time on it. Why do you think that you need to slander other people? Now, I don't know what this games urinalist has to say, but this is brought to my attention by Vito. It says in the news article about it, I don't know why Zach thinks that this is okay. It's not okay. You know, I would argue that this is likely to cause financial problems for Kotaku, because people with even deeper pockets than me are going to see this after you all share this video, which I hope that you do. I can see, you know, looking at Zach's social media, that he retweets a lot of, you know, far left talking points, like cringe points. You could see, I like that he's wearing his mask and his profile picture. That way, you know, that way, where he sits on mask mandates. That's, you know, an important thing that you put in your articles. And you see him retweeting stuff like, you know, I met I'm 36. I don't think in my lifetime there's ever been a national manhunt to find a black woman. I'm glad the family will have closure for Gabby, but my virtue signal. But my virtue signal. And it's other video games. Now, he's welcome to have his left-wing politics, and I can make fun of that. But I won't. What I won't do is slander and print lies about him, and I won't use Kotaku.com to do it. Kotaku needs to print a retraction, needs to remove this paragraph from this article. It's pretty simple to do. I don't need a public apology, but if you had any scruples at all, you would print a correction, because you're slandering these people as fact. It's going to be very expensive for you, I imagine.
Chapter 5. Captain Marvel writer told us to not buy her book. Now she's lamenting the collapse of the comic book industry.
Sometimes things just work out. I remember when Battlefield 5 came out and the game director was like, if you don't like it, don't buy it. When he was referring to the obvious virtue signaling that was existing in the game. And, well, we all know how that turned out. In fact, the sales for Battlefield 5 were disappointing, to say the least, according to EA. And it appears that they've actually learned their lesson going forward with the latest Battlefield, as we really haven't seen much of this kind of woke virtue signaling garbage that we saw with Battlefield 5. Now, if you aren't specifically familiar with comic books, you'll still enjoy this story. Kelly Sue DeConnick laments the abysmal state of comics after telling people to not buy her books. This is via Bounding Into Comics. Former Captain Marvel writer lamented that the state of the comic book in the state of the comic book industry after previously telling people to not buy her books. If you remember, this was a video on sci-fi. Comics are politics, Kelly Sue DeConnick in conversation with Sci-Fi Wire. Let's see how this turned out. Going back to October of 2017, a video that received a whopping 200 upvotes to 3,000 downvotes. This is what I'm talking about. Like, when you get off of Twitter and you start talking to regular folks, you realize pretty quickly that, yeah, it seems really loud and it seems like a lot of people are in this whole, like, everything's political band camp that exists on Twitter. You go to YouTube and it's exactly the opposite. There's absolutely no support for this. If you look at some of these comments, this is exactly why manga is outselling comics in the US and globally. He cares about the people who weren't born with privilege he was born with. I'm sorry, did I miss something? I didn't remember Captain America being born with super serum he has inside of him. 2017, don't buy my book. 2020, please buy my book. People are losing their jobs. Yes, problem solved. I won't buy your books. Well done. If you recall, DeConnick spoke to Sci-Fi Wire back in 2017 where she stated, and if you don't like my politics, don't buy my book. Later in the interview, she added, I'm going to make a book that I'm going to make, and if you don't want to read them, then don't read them. And I think that that's actually a fine position to have. I don't think that that is, excuse me, this is what a lot of people refer to as against consequence culture. I don't think that she should be forbidden from saying this, but I do think that you get what you deserve in terms of sales, in terms of pissing off your potential customers. When you spend too much time on Twitter, you think in your head that whatever you're doing, all this bashing of the male fandom and saying that there's all this stuff broken in comic books, you think that that's the right thing to say because it gets a lot of likes and retweets. But then you realize that oopsie doopsie poopsie, the people that actually did buy my books saw what I said and listened to me. DeConnick and her husband, Matt Fraction, were asked, did you think comics would be like this sort of phenomenon that it is currently? DeConnick answered, boy, it's a hard because from our perspective, the industry has contracted and we're very worried about comics right now. This is the latest interview from just a few days ago. So it's always interesting to me that outside perspectives is always comics are booming. It isn't that, though. Anybody who reads comics or who follows the comic book industry is pretty well-versed on the fact that it is not doing well. DeConnick answered, boy, that's hard again. Faction then turned in, Fraction, her husband, I don't think I share. I think you're more pessimistic about it than I am. I understand the why of it all. But I also feel like he would then go on to discuss how comic book merchandising has blown up and how The Walking Dead and Scott Pilgrim were the biggest presences at San Diego Comic-Con. Okay, but when you have, you know, artists or, you know, the people that are selling the product, if I sold hot dogs and I was going on the internet telling everyone to not buy my hot dogs, and then I would, like, shocked Pikachu face when sales were in the tank, you know, you told a large section of the comic book buying public, not so subtly, that you didn't want them to buy your books. You spent all day yelling at them and berating them on Twitter, telling them that you were right and they were wrong, and that they shouldn't be following you because you wrote Spider-Man or Captain Marvel, that they should be following you because you want to talk about politics, because that's really what you want to talk about. And you slowly eroded that relationship you had with your customers over, you know, 2015, 2016, 2017. And now we're in 2021 and the industry has collapsed. And the independent comic book industry has, you know, siphoned off maybe $10 million a year in sales, maybe more. And people are fine not buying the latest Batman comic book when they have good indies to look forward to. Now he says, Fraction then stated, when we go to shows now and people bring us things to sign we've never seen, it's crazy. It's inconceivable at some level. But I think there's something cyclical in comics. Its ability to tap into popular imagination, whether it was Superman in the 30s, Batman in the 60s, you have these moments where comic book saturation everywhere. Still, books, articles get written in the mainstream media with pow and zap, right? I still think maybe depending on the day you ask, my pessimism would vary. Well, I think that, you know, that's a valid point. There are cycles in terms of, you know, what's interesting and what's selling. The difference is in this cycle, your industry collapsed when comic book heroes were never more popular. The comic book industry collapsed at the absolute height of the comic book industry. Think about that. It's because the people selling the books have never been more accessible. And because they got so many Twitter followers and Facebook followers because of their work with books, like, you know, that people loved, they thought that suddenly people cared about their opinions on, you know, Donald Trump or, you know, other political issues. And while half of them, let's say roughly half, agreed, that's actually not even fair. To be honest, when you look at, excuse me, politically divisive posts, right? It isn't 50-50. It's like 30-30-30. You know, 10% of people, 30-30-30-10. 10% of the people don't care. 30% of the people are turned off, even if they agree with you by you talking about politics. And then you get 30% of people who agree with you, and then 30% of people who disagree with you. If you didn't discuss politics at all, you'd still have 100% of the audience that you had before you did. DeConnick would then lay out just how bad the shape of the comic book industry is in. I think I tend to be pretty optimistic, but this one, I'm worried. I'm straight worried. When asked why, she responded, because stores are closing at a phenomenal rate. Independent comic book sales are down. Mainstream comic book sales are down, except for the top three or five books are up. Everything in the mid-list is way down. Numbers that used to be numbers that would get you canceled are now like, no, that's a hit. Independent books making back the cost of doing floppies is like names that should be able to do it no sweat and are going into the red on singles and not coming out until the trades, and that worries me. Well, this is a rod of your own making, isn't it? DeConnick continued, the other thing that worries me is that we're heavily dominated by the superhero genre, and we're heavily dominated by DC and Marvel as the most successful shared universe in comics. And I have nothing against DC and Marvel. I've worked for them both. I love them both. I love both universes. I think superheroes are great. But there is no part of me that's like, I had your first album and it's great. I can love independent comics and I can love superhero comics. But I have a concern that while the industry not quite is what it used to be, it is still heavily dominated by those two companies, and those two companies have gradually become part of the larger behemoth corporations, and comics have always been special because of the way they work in the brain and because of the way we always have been cheap and fast and therefore innovative. So we could try things in comics before it's far less expansive to screw up in comics. Faction adds, entire management suites of Hollywood studios get fired for taking the kind of chances we take every week in comics. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's interesting. You know, they clearly understand the model. But I think it's hilarious that just a few years ago, you told us to not buy your stuff. I don't know. There's such a huge demographic of middle-aged women who still try to present like they're 19. Yeah, I mean, in the way they talk, in the way that they dress, I think it's hilarious to me. But in the end of the day, you get what you deserve.
Chapter 6. Chilling eyewitness call reveals Gabby Petito under attack by boyfriend Brian Laundry.
What's going on, everyone? Jeremy here from The Quarrying with an update in the Gabby Petito case. Looks like, you know, based on your feedback, people are pretty interested in following this as it goes through. So make sure you hit that red subscribe button down below to be notified each and every time I upload. Now, what's interesting is a couple new little nuggets came out today.
including we now know that Brian, we assume, is in the van at the time. You can see video shows Gabby Petito's van door closing 3 days after last sighting. Enhanced video footage of Gabby Petito's van, purportedly filmed after her last known sighting, has surfaced online, appearing to show the back door of the vehicle being closed as another car approaches. The chilling moment was spotted by Brent Shavnor, a U.S. Marine Corps veteran turned videographer, who noticed the movement on the video first posted on YouTube. The Bethunes captured the encounter on their dash cam, traveling cross country. They say the footage was recorded in Spread Creek, Dispersed Camping Land, Grand Teton National Park. I think Dispersed Camping Land just means like, you're good. You can camp basically wherever you want. Wait, I wanted to see the... Well, show me the video. Video picked up movement around the van. Shavnor was able to further enhance the footage, but of course Newsweek is not going to link to it because they're probably not getting paid, which is pretty crummy. Shout out to Brent Shavnor here. Thanks to the raw 2.5K video released by Red, White, and Bethune, I was able to further enhance the footage of the back door of the Gabby Petito Brian Laundrie point, where you can clearly see the back door abruptly close. Let's check this out. Oh, yeah, you can see it's open there. You can see the door's open here. And then, boom. I mean, I don't know if you could say it's abruptly. It says, as requested, here's a second anomaly. Some thought might have been Brian digging in the creek. You can see in the enhanced video that the black figure is not a human figure, more aligned with being terrain. Oh, right over there on the left. I mean, the idea is, he writes on, answer your question regarding the significance of the door closing. Building a timeline of the case is important. The door closing adds whether or not information on the timeline. Someone was alive in the van where Gabby was found on August 27th. And you can see here, front passenger seat, wind slowed down and exposure, contrast, and brightness altered. Clearly, a male passenger in the passenger seat resembles the boyfriend. I mean, you can see it does look like him there. Brightness increased higher. You can see if that's what they're talking about. You know, if it was him. There's been a lot of mention of a face appearing in the passenger window as a vehicle passes by Gabby's van for a second time. As requested, here's the spot up close in question. Pretty creepy three frames. I don't know if maybe. See, I wasn't even looking at the, oh, right here. That is creepy. Okay. So he's looking out the window. Yeah, that's, I mean, could it be like a really bizarre phenomenon? Maybe, but it looks pretty much like a dude. As requested, here is the windshield, the Red, White, and Bethune. We're leaving. Not sure he can make anything definitive. There's definitely someone in the van, and I'm pretty sure it's him. I don't know why that's that surprising. You could see him here, and when the video plays between 3 and 4 seconds, his face is against the window. So as they're driving by, he's peeking out, and he's looking. Oh, he's right here. Yeah. Yeah, it looks like he is. It's possible. The picture of their van, though, there is a wall. So he'd have to be up front. Oh, there's a blanket hanging. There looks to be some type of bag in the front seat. So maybe he was laying down. Maybe he was there. What do you guys see? This is actually getting pretty interesting. It appeared to be Brian's as they were a few inches shy of the size 15. Oh, they're talking about the shoes that were also found. There were also shoes found that it also looks to be Brian's, not Gabby's.
On top of all of this, there is new information on a 911 call that he claimed he saw Brian Laundry slapping Gabby Petito. A massive search is continuing in Southern Florida for Brian Laundry, the boyfriend of Gabby Petito, the 22-year-old woman who went missing on a cross-country trip. Here's the thing. Here's something a lot of people are talking about, too. Did the parents help get him out of there? Because it certainly looks suspect that basically people were watching this house 24/7 and somehow the boyfriend got out. You know, he's been named as a person of interest in the case. But according to this call, he claimed he saw him hit her. Now, we do know that by her own admission, she hit him in this incident. But the call is what led to this traffic stop. Apparently, he was chasing her up and down a sidewalk and raising his hands to her. We drove by, the gentleman said, and the gentleman was raising his hand to her. He told the call, and then we stopped. They ran up and down the sidewalk. He proceeded to raise his hands to her, hopped in the car, and drove off. What's interesting is then the PD stops, interviews them, and lets them go their separate ways. If you look at this, you know, this scenario, boy, I mean, I wonder if they had arrested somebody in this. You might, you know, you don't want to think about that. You see Nancy Grace here saying, how long has Brian Laundry really been gone? She questions how Lundy could have left the house unseen considering constant press coverage. Is it possible that he snuck out at, you know, 4 a.m. when everyone is asleep? Yeah, sure, it's possible. But it's an interesting thing, and maybe that's why the parents were questioned. And there was this red herring, perhaps, about the Carlton Reserve, which is a nature preserve where Brian Laundry was supposedly headed. She writes, with all the press and citizens outside the home, how did Laundry get out and nobody noticed? That place has been staked out 24/7. Did he really go to the Carlton Reserve? Why do we believe that? Other than that's what the parents said. I don't understand how the car could have left with him in it. And then the parents bring it back and nobody sees any of this happening. I'm also very concerned about the condition in which Gabby was found. You know, what would that tell us? Well, obviously, yeah, you'd want to know, you know, is there evidence of foul play? Was it, you know, a slip and fall? Was it, I mean, it's difficult to know for sure. You know, there's also this weird thing where he checked in on her phone in Puerto Rico. That's really interesting, isn't it? I wanted to pull that up quick. I forgot to put up the article. This is just 2 days ago. And you see social media users think he's fled to Puerto Rico. Gabby Petito's family says her fiance is hiding and people think they know where. Social media users think Brian is in Puerto Rico based on geotagging data from their hiking and app All Trails. Investigators are now working with multiple missing persons investigation. It's interesting to me. You have in a statement they think he's hiding. Obviously, he's had weeks now to get ahead. You see, can't sleep because all I can think about Gabby case when user tweeted. Now looking at their All Trails account, assuming it's really hers, why is it saying Puerto Rico? In a follow-up tweet, that user wrote, do we think that Brian Laundry has her phone and has fled to Puerto Rico? It's easy from Florida, but wouldn't the airport notify anyone? Well, what if you took a, you know, private jet or a charter flight? I don't know how all that works. Another user posted a screenshot of direct flights from Tampa. It's not far from Northport to San Juan, Puerto Rico. Spirit Airlines, American Airlines, Frontier, JetBlue all offer flights from Tampa to San Juan. And the thing is, he could have gone before anyone was even looking for him. Now, if they find him in Puerto Rico, you know, they'll still be able to extradite him to the United States. But things are getting spicy. I suspect more information will come out tonight. I'll make sure I keep you all updated on that. If you can, if you haven't yet, make sure you click that subscribe button down below the video to stay up to date on all the latest news, not just this. And we'll talk to you again real soon.